Welcome to Headlines. I'm Aaron Parnas, host of the Chinuch 2.0 show, and today we're going to discuss the topic of girls' seminaries. This topic is very complex, and there are many angles to cover, and none of it is straightforward. I want to start off by saying that I tried very hard to get people from seminaries to join us and was unsuccessful. Truth be told, it's the beginning of the school year and they're dealing with a lot of issues. There's a quarantine, Yomim Tovim coming up, school starting. So I hope, Emirat Hashem, to have some representation from the seminaries on a future show. In the meantime, those of you who have attended seminary in Eretz Yisrael, or if you have daughters who attended, you can help us understand more about this topic by filling out a quick survey at seminarysurvey.com. Again, the information from the survey will help us greatly as we prepare for a future show on the subject. I want to focus our discussion on five different points regarding girls' seminaries in Eretz Yisrael. Number one, the price of seminary. Unfortunately, sending a girl to Eretz Yisrael in seminary is not cheap. Tuition is about $25,000, and that doesn't cover the cost of air travel, cell phones, insurance, and spending money. Very often, the parents will come visit their daughter in the middle of the year, adding another couple of thousand dollars to the mix. Even seminaries themselves agree that going to seminary is very expensive. I'm going to read you a section of the contract from one of the seminaries that was sent to me by a parent who had to sign it as part of the registration process. A personal and sincere note to parents, we are fully aware that the cost of attending seminary in Eretz Yisrael is an expensive, albeit worthwhile endeavor that will enhance your daughter's spiritual, social, and academic growth. We greatly admire and appreciate those parents who, with great mesiras nefesh, make this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity available to their daughters in spite of the financial strains such a decision might put on their budget. Nevertheless, we ask you that you take time to consider if and how you can make this choice a fiscal reality for your daughter, and if you really do have the means to offer her this priceless opportunity that nonetheless does carry a price tag. And then they go on to continue and say that if after research and consideration, you're not able to fulfill this obligation, please do not sign this application. Here's a clip from the Pesach of Shmuel First of Chicago in an earlier show with David Lichtenstein about the high cost of attending seminary.
We have the honor of having with us from Chicago, Rav HaGoyin Rav Shmuel First. He's the Rav of Agudas Yisrael of Chicago. He is the Dayan of the Aguda, and he the famous Pesach from Chicago. Welcome, Rav First.
Yes.
So, Rabbi First, we had on a parent who was crying that they sent their child to seminary. They sent three daughters to seminary. Yeah. And they said the cost is around, with airfare and everything, it's between $25,000 and $30,000 a kid.
Yeah.
And because it's considered if you don't send your kid to seminary today, it's going to shter shidduchim. And I know the mir is five.
If they can't afford it, they should not send them to Eretz Yisrael. There's such a thing as betachon and rabbanu shalom. The zivik is already written before abav yom kaimtzias of lad. Going to Eretz Yisrael will not make a difference if they can get married or not. If they can't afford to go to Yisrael, then they should not go to Eretz Yisrael. I think it's a highway robbery that they're charging such high amounts in Eretz Yisrael. They don't, for Bochum, they only charge that amount. And they don't even give them even, they don't even give Shabbos, they don't even give even meals then. They're, according to the people who know, it costs them about $8,000 a year, each student. The rest is pure profit.
So, Rabbi First, what can we do as a community if it's costing parents $25,000 to $30,000?
I think they should stop sending their children to Eretz Yisrael. If a bunch of parents get together or the school gets together and makes their own seminary and continue after 12th grade, make your own seminary. It'll be a lot cheaper and make a lot of parents happy. Who says you have to go to Eretz Yisrael?
And do you find that, first, that the year in Eretz Yisrael is worth the $25,000 or $30,000? Do you find that to be case as a head of a community? Do you see that it's worth that impact?
Certain families, it's a beautiful thing to go to Israel. Certain families, it's not necessary. I think it depends on each family. Certain families, it's good for the kids to get away. Certain ones, it doesn't make a difference. I think if we change the trend, not everyone has to go to Israel. It'll help a lot of families, and it'll bring a lot of shalom bayis in Klal Yisrael.
So, even if one will argue that it is important for girls to go to Eretz Yisrael for seminary, is it worth the price that we have to pay for it? For most families, the price is a great strain, even if they're making nice incomes from their jobs. We are going to hear from two noted shadchanim who will weigh in on this very question. Also, as a side note, last year, all the girls who were in Eretz Yisrael were forced to come home early because of the coronavirus outbreak. A parent whose daughter was there told me that as soon as the pandemic hit, they heard nothing from the seminary. The seminary did not contact the parents at all. The parents had to make their own arrangements for their daughters to get home safely. And for a few months, they heard nothing from the seminary. About a month after Pesach, one of the girls in the seminary called her friends and said that they're going to have some sort of classes by phone for a few hours a day. And then at the end of the year, a few of the Rebbetzins from the seminary came in to have some sort of getaway for 2 or 3 days. Other than that, they heard nothing from the seminary, not about sending the girls home, and nothing about refunding all the money that wasn't needed for that third of a year that the girls weren't in seminary. Now, we understand that there are some fixed costs that the seminary has to pay regardless if the girls are there or not. But there definitely was a lot of money saved by the fact that the girls went home. There was no food cost, no utility cost, no trip cost, no transportation cost, and many, many other costs that they saved, which is only right that money should go back to the parents. I'm not chas v'shalom suspecting the seminaries of keeping money that doesn't belong to them. I'm sure they have some justification for doing so. But as I said, there was no one available to come on the program to explain their side of the story. The second issue that I want to bring up is what the girls are learning while they're in seminary. This week's parasha talks about the mitzvah of hakel. And the Torah says, hakel es ha'am anashim nashim v'taf. So the Gemara in Chagiga says that the men, anashim, come to learn, and the women come l'shmoya, to hear. Why does it use the word l'shmoya, to hear, when it talks about the women? And the answer, as stated by the Rishonim, is that the women who don't have a mitzvah to learn Torah, the purpose of them coming to Hakel is just to hear. The Maritz Chayas over there in the Gemara in Chagiga says that this would be a raya to what's mashma from the Rambam, that even though women are not supposed to learn Torah Shebaal Peh, the Rambam seems to imply that even Torah Shebechsav, even the written Torah, it might not be ki'ilu Melamda Tiflas on Torah Shebechsav, but it's still not a good thing for women to be taught Torah Shebechsav. So the purpose of the women coming to Hakel is just to hear and be inspired from the listening to the words of Torah, and not for the sake of learning. Of course, there's the famous Heter, Harasha of the Gedolim of previous generations, that's been universally accepted to have Beis Yaakov schools, because otherwise we wouldn't have a Klal Yisrael. Of course, in every community, girls are taught Torah, and they're taught Yerushalayim, and that's how we have a Jewish nation. But we have to know, to what extent does the Heter to teach Torah go? Are girls able to learn Mishnayos, Gemara? If you look through the contemporary Paiskim, or Moshe Feinstein and many others, they say that women are not supposed to be learning intense Limud. Are we following the proper Masorah by teaching girls on such a high level? Speaking about Masorah, there's a seminary in Eretz Yisrael by the name of Masoras Rachel, where the girls have to write what's called a Medrash report. I interviewed a few girls who attended the seminary, and they told me that they spend between 90 to 100 hours throughout the year on a report that requires them to put together what's like a thesis on a specific topic, weaving together Midrashim and other Chazals, Marals, and other Mefarshim. And it often requires a lot of input from the girls' fathers and or brothers. Do we say that the Hayras Shah of the Gedolim of previous generations, who gave the Heter for the Beis Yaakov movement, goes so far? I reached out to Mrs. Rina Tarshish of the seminary, and unfortunately, she declined to come on the show. The third point that I want to bring up is, have seminaries changed from the original purpose of seminaries? We're going to hear at great length from Yehuda Geberer, who is a noted historian and the host of the Jewish History Soundbites podcast, how seminaries were designed just to develop teachers who would be able to teach in the Beis Yaakov schools. It was never meant that all girls should attend seminary. The seminaries that were originally started were very exclusive, and they only took the very, very best girls who were going to be teachers of the next generation. It was never meant that every single girl should attend seminary. The next point that's very important to bring up is regarding shidduchim. Many people are under the impression that their daughters have to go to seminary in Eretz Yisrael or else they won't get read shidduchim. That's how they justify sending them, even at great personal expense, because they feel that that's the only way my daughter could get married. We're going to speak to two noted shadchanim, Shlomi Lewinstein and Sada Katz, who are going to clear up some common misconceptions about this topic. And the final topic that I want to bring up in this introduction is regarding the pressure from the high schools. In the past few days of doing research for this show, I've heard countless stories of how girls that weren't planning on going to seminary were pressured into applying and registering because of the pressure from their school. There's a story of a girl who attended a prestigious high school in Lakewood. I'm not going to say the name of the school until we give the principal a chance to come on the show, where the girl told the principal that she wasn't planning on going to Eretz Yisrael for seminary because her parents can't afford it. Yet nevertheless, the principal called her out repeatedly during the season of seminary applications, insisting that she apply and register because a girl like you shouldn't go to seminary. So before we go to our guests, I just want to say once again that this topic is very complex and no one should jump to any conclusions one way or another. One show on this topic is definitely not enough. So that's why I'm calling on people involved in seminaries to come on the show and discuss this topic so that we could share both sides of the story and address the concerns that we're bringing up over here. And again, the answers that our audience can give us to the survey, which is at seminarysurvey.com, will help us better understand the issues and how people really feel about this topic. Let's go to our guests. I'm speaking with Rabbi Yoel Kramer. He is a veteran mechanech. He was the principal of Prospect Park Benoslea High School for almost 35 years. And he was also the educational director of Benos Chava Seminary for 25 years. And he runs the Merkaz Center for Teacher Training. Welcome, Rabbi Yoel.
Welcome.
So, Rabbi Kramer, the question is like this. Parents, there's really two questions. Parents have to make a great sacrifice to send their girls to seminary in Eretz Yisrael. It's a big financial decision. What are the girls, what are we trying to get at? What are we trying to accomplish from this year? Talking about a typical Beis Yaakov girl who grew up in a strong Torah value home, what's she trying to accomplish from a year in seminary? And also, what is the role of her high school in that decision? Like, should the high school be encouraging the girls to go? Sometimes they put a tremendous amount of pressure on the girls. What is the role of the high school in this decision?
Okay, so to clarify, I counseled as a high school principal girls who were graduating from 1970 to 1995. My answers, therefore, are classic answers that fit for that period of time. I will also share with you as I list the points, the Yerida, the decline of the Dor since then, and how some of these answers are mitigated in a way, some of these reasons, rather, are mitigated because of the decline of time. The classic reasons that I would share with a parent are, number one, your daughter has moved, has had all decisions made for her. She's been an adolescent. She's in a school that you decided and is doing basically most of what you decided. Now she moves into an adult or era of adult life, moves out of adolescence into an adult life and eventually marriage. What this year does is give her an opportunity to exclusively spend her time in Torah and see the depths of Torah with no chayil, with nothing else around. It will shape her. It will focus her goals as she builds adult living and builds a house. One of the arguments always is, but what seminars are doing are brainwashing. I always contended that perhaps we should look at it from a different perspective. Maybe up to now, until age 18, her life has been a brainwashed life, brainwashed by her home and whatever that values are, by the society that she lives in. And maybe now it's taking her out of that brainwashing into open exposure where she begins to see new things. It's a counter to the brainwashing argument. Another reason, exposure to a new world, to new levels of avodah, to new levels, to new values, to new expectations, to a lifestyle of subsistence or more low-keyed, to just new people and new places. As an example, I have a granddaughter who was sent to seminary just last week. The decision by her parents, she comes from a Midwest city where she was born there. All of her exposure is basically that Midwest city. And its values and the friends and all basically limited. Obviously, trips to Bobby and Zaidi and such. But they felt that despite the present situation, that exposure and that breadth was important and therefore sent her, despite the bidud and the difficulties that are going on now. Exposure also to new girls and girls with hopefully higher she'ifas, higher goals. The average classroom is a heterogeneous classroom. The average seminary is more homogeneous and maybe elevates the girl by exposure to other girls who want to step more. Now, once again, understand that if people are going to make decisions that don't do this, this choice of the seminary is one where there are not girls who are coming for the right reason, and obviously this argument and this reason is less so. Let's go on. Another reason is the importance of independence. For a girl to go off and make decisions, plans, problem solving, and dealing with the normal challenges, everyday challenges, by herself is a very valuable point. Now, the Yerida of the Dor is, I sent children away 40 years ago, our daughters 40, 30 years ago to seminary. We spoke by telephone four times during the year, before Yom Tovim, birthdays. Don't laugh now. when we know the girls are sent off, they may talk four times a day. So this reason is basically not a reason anymore when the parent is a helicopter parent. If one would send a girl off and not have her call daily to say what she had for breakfast and how her tummy hurts, and what should she do for Shabbos, then of course it's less of a reason. Another reason is the depth of Torah learning. She is exposed without being involved in the Mudichol. Her whole day is just Torah learning. She's exposed to the depth of preparation. She's exposed, if it's a good seminary, to the depth of independent research to match the whole that she eventually, when she comes back, might be involved in. Somehow, not somehow, but it makes it clear that Torah learning has a level that she's not been exposed to in the past and may not be in the future. One of the other arguments was always, what's the alternative? When I counseled, there was very little alternative on this side of the ocean. So what a girl did was continue to just segue and do the same thing she did in high school, talk to her friends half a night, do nothing really substantial, often no academics, no thinking, certainly no Torah learning, no evening classes. Much of that was not available. And very often, going on to chol only, to higher learning in the academic, secular world. And that pulling her so that she would go through a week without any Torah in her life. Nowadays, on the positive side, There have been new seminaries of higher level that have opened up on this side of the ocean, and often that's an argument. That's an argument that it may be less a crucial or a compelling nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of the price. Let's deal with that. When I sent, it was a fraction of what the price is nowadays. And children went and stayed there the entire year. They didn't bounce back every second cousin Simcha. And certainly children went, all of our children went, they stayed for Pesach.
And no parents came to visit them in the middle of the year either,
and
right?
No parent came to visit, and if they did, they were not at the classic hotel entertaining all of the other students. So it was a different world, and therefore the advantages and the costs were not so
justified.
Extreme.
Right.
Nowadays, it's quite different. And therefore, to answer your question, high schools should not be pressuring. They should list, as I just did now, all of the advantages, but understand that if a parent can, then to see what one could do to draw out some of these advantages that I listed and see that if they cannot be done in some other way. Mm-hmm. I think that basically I've summarized the major points for parents to think of.
Okay, so this, I mean, this practice that today, you have many schools, especially out-of-town schools, where virtually every single girl is going to seminary in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, based on what you said before, it's something that really the parents should the parents and the girls should think about, and go through the reasons that you said, and decide, is that something that they really absolutely need, and if they,
right.
And if they can afford it.
And the present pandemic situation has jolted us, as it has in many, many of our values, jolted us to think and reanalyze.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to caution again that if one does go, that it be to a place that's not just, to use the teenage term, a blast.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome. All these adolescent turns there's a, I'll end with a good joke. If one hears this screeching kind of sound on the streets of Yerushalayim, it's either an ambulance rushing to some accident or incident, or two seminary girls who met on the streets of Malchi Yisrael, and they haven't seen each other since yesterday. I thought you'd enjoy the joke.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're not gonna. I wished that syndrome get broken, and then that's not the purpose of Semin.
Rabbi Kramer, thank you very much for your heartfelt words and your advice, and really appreciate you participating in the program.
My pleasure.
We're speaking to two well-known Shadchanim, Shlomi Lewinstein and Sada Katz. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, how are you doing, Rabbi?
So, let's say I have a daughter in 12th grade, and it's coming time when all the girls are choosing seminaries, and we're not so excited about sending our daughter to Eretz Yisrael to seminary. It's very expensive and for many other reasons, but we're afraid that if we don't send her to Eretz Yisrael for seminary, she won't be able to get a good shidduch. In your opinion, is this something that we should be overly worried about?
I think that the whole idea that a girl has to go to seminary to Yisrael is relatively new. It's probably less than 20 years old. I think it's mainly teachers that are promoting this and some parents. When I speak to many, many boys, they really don't care where the girl went to seminary, if it's Eretz Yisrael or in America. Obviously, it should be similar to the type of shidduch or type of culture that they are in. I mean, it definitely is important where you go to anything for school, camp, or seminary. But Eretz Yisrael and America, the fear that's put in my humble opinion, is not really genuine that it's a real problem. It's just a mindset that people have that you have to go to Eretz Yisrael to get a good shidduch. What's important for you, for your daughter, for Shidduchim, is do what's best for her. Don't think so much about what people are going to think in Shidduchim. You do what's best for her. Most girls, I find, do very well at home in Lakewood, New York, Borough Park, wherever they live. There are excellent seminaries. Actually, I have two daughters that went to Bnos Chaim in Lakewood. There's Rev Sinovsky has a seminary, and there's excellent seminaries in New York, quality, excellent quality. So the whole idea that Israel versus America in quality is definitely, there's no question that American seminaries are just as good, maybe better. And you have the advantage that your daughter's home, which is where a girl really should be. So if you're worried about shidduchim, I think you should just do what's right for your daughter and make that decision. So I'm not going to tell you which seminary is actually better for her, but in just the question of Israel versus America, that's nothing to worry about.
Shlomi, you want to add your thoughts?
Yeah. And I would say in the end of the day, I don't think anyone really cares, you know, where the girl went to seminary. That's, you know, obviously people, once they meet and they get to know each other, it's irrelevant. You know, there's, like Tzadok was saying, there's, as far as the chinuch is concerned, there's excellent seminaries in locally in Lakewood and in New York. And, you know, maybe this there are people in the field of chinuch that are encouraging the idea that a girl must go to Eretz Yisrael. But, you know, as far as I know, as far as from what I understand, I don't see, I mean, I'm not saying there's no exceptions, there's no people that could gain from the time in Eretz Yisrael. You know, I mean, who says it has to be for a whole year? Maybe it should be for a couple of months. But from what I see, there's excellent chinuch, you know, in the local ones, and there's good ones in Eretz Yisrael. But that the girl must go, I don't see the need.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. A lot of people feel that when a girl goes to Eretz Yisrael, she gains a certain independence and maturity because she's away from home and she's learning to live on her own. As opposed to in America, she's home, she's with her parents, she hasn't learned to be on her own, so it doesn't prepare her for marriage as well. Do you feel that that's true? Is that a real concern? Or is that just something that's blown out of proportion?
There's definitely some advantages to Eretz Yisrael, and there's definitely some advantages to America. On one hand, I could make the argument that the girls in America, when they're much more grounded when they leave seminary. They already have jobs prepared. They have their resumes. They know what they're doing. A lot of them even start their jobs. They go into the new year already all prepared. The girls that land from Eretz Yisrael and then they go to camp and then comes El and then Sukkot and then, you know, they're starting to land when they're Hanukkah time. So I think that the American girls have definitely an advantage over Eretz Yisrael. But Eretz Yisrael also has advantages. You know, they do a lot of chesed and they do get some independence. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good. The mile of Eretz Yisrael is machkim, and there's a lot of miles of being in Eretz Yisrael. But like Shlomi said, that could be, you know, you could do a month, and a lot of the seminaries do a trip. And but again, there are definitely some advantages to being away from home, that you could build some independence. And there's definitely a lot of advantages being with home with your mother, helping out your family, and staying local. That's just my feeling.
I mean, I could hear that argument that a girl will gain a level of maturity from going to Eretz Yisrael to be on her own. You know, I'm not really sure if there's such a difference between on that angle between Eretz Yisrael and camp. You know, a lot of girls go to camp in the summer and they're also away from home. You know, and as far as maturity and independence, I think that, like Tzadok was saying, there's a mile to America too, because girls are more grounded over here in America. Some of them are beginning to take college courses and you know, they go to start, you know, getting their careers going, which definitely does raise the level of maturity in that way. So, you know, like there's miles to in Eretz Yisrael, there's miles in America in that angle. But I would say that this, again, it's not a must to go to Eretz Yisrael for that reason.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so to wrap it all up over here, we'll start with Shlomi first. In your opinion, do you feel that the seminary experience in Eretz Yisrael, which costs a fortune, it could be $35,000, and for many families, it's a very big struggle. Do you feel that it's a worthwhile investment for a person to mutchazach to send their daughter for that price tag?
So, you know, it depends who. You know, there are girls that definitely grow a lot and gain a tremendous amount from going. So for those girls, maybe, you know, you can make an argument that it'll be worth it. But to make it that it's a must for people to go, that it's something that a girl has to do, $35,000 is a tremendous amount of money. I guess you mean between the tuition, the traveling, mm-hmm. the clothing that they need, the expenses of a girl living there, and a lot of them are spending extra money going to restaurants and going places and so forth and so on. So I guess that all adds up to the 35. You know, there's many families that have numerous girls. Baruch Hashem, you have families that have 5, 6, 7, 8 girls, and there's a limit to what people can spend. You know, people are being mechanech their kids for 12 grades and paying tuition. And, you know, the schools, and we have great schools in America that are teaching the girls, you know, the right things. And all of a sudden to say that you must go and that year should be 5 times the amount that it costs to be in America through the first 12 grades is just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And let's remember, a lot of families, you know, if I could bring up a story that a high school principal once told me. He once told me that a girl came to him for a transcript. I think that's the paper that you need in order to get into seminary. You need that paper from high school. And he looked at the girl. I don't know if he said anything to her, but it upset him because this is a girl that's parents did not pay tuition for high school. I don't know if they didn't pay that year or they didn't pay the whole time. And, you know, tuition in high school in the Lakewood school, what is it, $6,000-$7,000. And all of a sudden, this girl, all of a sudden, they found the money to go to Eretz Yisrael. Like, what happened here? So, and, you know, many families are struggling. When the girl finishes seminary, now we got to go find the shidduch. And they gotta, you gotta make a wedding for her, which is a very big amount. And then after that, you have you have support. You know, your parent has to support their kids in kollel. So, I would think that it would be a tremendous advantage to if it could be avoided that big amount of money to spend. Let's keep them home. It's a third of the price to keep them home. They could get started with their career, start with their jobs on some level, put away some money, and in a financial way, they're way ahead if they stay home. So I can't say it's a waste for everybody, but I would say for a lot of people, it's really, really not kedai. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Tzadok, you wanna
speak? Yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna speak as much as Lowenstein, but I don't see how it's kedai. It's an extreme luxury that for sure someone who's struggling or taking stock definitely has no right to invest that money for, even if there is a small advantage. Another mystery, I think it's the missing sock mystery, is no one knows why it costs $30,000 for a seminary in Eretz Yisrael. One of the owners of a seminary in America told me that the highest paid Rebbetzin in Eretz Yisrael, which means that you're teaching for 25 years, gets less than the most elementary seminary teacher gets in America. And in America, they can only charge $7,000, $8,000, whatever the prices are. So besides the fact that you're not getting buck for your money, you know, the question is why is there such an extreme expense? It doesn't make any sense. You have some seminaries that have a building from 40 years ago, and you know, they're making a lot of money. They make a lot of money on registration, and there's something missing. And I think we should all one day, everyone should get up and say, question one, is it worth the money? And why does it cost so much money? Mm-hmm. So from my little opinion as a shatran, I don't think it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you both for joining us and sharing your thoughts and clearing up a lot of the confusion around this very, very complex topic.
Sure. Anytime.
We're speaking with Yehuda Geberer. He's a Jewish historian, a tour guide, and he's the host of a very popular podcast called Jewish History Soundbites, which I listen to almost every single episode. And he's actually in middle of discussing this very topic, the history of the Beis Yaakov movement. Welcome, Yehuda.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's a privilege. Thank you for having me.
So we're talking about seminaries and girls' seminaries and how they came about to be. So just to set up the historical context, for generations, girls weren't formally taught any Torah. That was a given, that girls weren't supposed to be taught Torah, and they weren't taught Torah. Is it true that girls didn't even know how to read Hebrew?
Very often it was true. There were many girls who did, many girls who were able to read minimal Hebrew or Yiddish, very often without understanding what they're saying. But overall, for most of the generations, there were a very high rate of illiteracy. They absorbed the atmosphere, the cultural atmosphere of Judaism, of Yiddishkeit, in their home, but there was definitely no education, formal or informal, very little. There was isolated incidents and individuals. Some towns had something, but nothing systematic, no real education.
Yeah, so talk about the historical context, the conditions that brought about a very drastic change to that, and the, what were the things going on that gave rise to the Beis Yaakov movement?
So the modern times brought a lot of changes to the Jewish people, and almost every institution we have is a product of the modern era and the challenges that the Jewish people face. Once Jews in many countries in Europe received emancipation, so they started integrating into the surrounding societies, and even in Eastern Europe and the Russian Empire, where Jews did not receive emancipation, but the winds of change arrived there as well. All kinds of changes are up and about, and that's overall, that's affecting everyone, every family, every community. There's some more than others, the bigger cities more than the smaller towns, and that's the story of the Jews of the modern era. What specifically was facing girls is that, A, they didn't have any educational system that gave them a proper foundation or connection to Yiddishkeit that their male counterparts had. In addition to the fact that because of emancipation, especially in Galicia, in places of the Austro-Hungarian Empire where the Jews received full emancipation, there started to be compulsory education. So you have to go to public school. The fathers were willing to pay a fine to allow their sons to go to cheder instead of the public school. But the girls, they'll go to public school. So you have a couple of generations, starting in the 1800s already, where girls are attending public school in many areas of Europe, from religious homes, from Hasidish homes in Hungary and Galicia and other places, even in Russia, where it wasn't exactly compulsory, they're going to, so now they're speaking the local language, whether it's German or Polish or Hungarian or whatever it is, as a first language. They're absorbing the values and the literature and the culture and of the surrounding society, and there becomes this wider and wider gap between the boys and the girls, and it became a crisis, that and all kinds of other things that were going on. And you could elaborate it on the specifics of all these issues, but at the end of the day, it was a crisis. It was a crisis that created that there was literally no future. And the Jewish education wasn't started to create kollel wives. It was to save Yiddishkeit. There would have been no Jews left, and there would have been no Shmiras Shabbos. There would have been nothing. There would have been no Jewish home. And what seemed to be a possible solution was education for girls. And it was already proposed. It wasn't that Sarshanir, came up with the idea. She was one who actually did it. It was already proposed before that. And Germany was already done by Rabbi Shamshon of Polhirsch way before that. But she went out and actually did it into the trenches. It would seem to have been that this might be a solution to the problem.
So it was really a case where a majority of Jewish girls were going off the derech, not being from, not keeping any mitzvahs?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it was a really desperate situation. I mean, the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know if you're going to mention it, the Chafetz Chaim writes in his in the Likutei Halachas, he says that it, today, when the girls know how to read the languages of the nations, and they don't live with their parents. They're living in a different place. So what does he mean by that? What was the situation then that he's referring to?
So the Chafetz Chaim is a great way to get into the discussion, because that heter, if we'll call it that, of the Chafetz Chaim for girls to study Torah is usually pointed to as the basis for allowing Beis Yaakov, for allowing girls education, because the main deterrent until that point was that girls are not allowed to study Torah. And the Chafetz Chaim and Likutei Halachas, now I'm not the halacha guy, I don't know if someone else on the show is, I don't know any halacha, I'm not getting into the Torah discussion, but in the historical process, the isser of teaching girls Torah had to be dealt with by the traditional community. And the Chafetz Chaim, who actually, I quoted it, I went along with a lot of the authors who write about this Chafetz Chaim, who dated to 1911, and I quoted on the on my podcast the other day, but in reality, I was corrected by the one who discovered that it was actually 1921, Rachel Menachem, a professor who wrote on the subject. And Chafetz Chaim published in 1921. Why does it make such a big difference if it's 1911 or 1921? It's very simple.
World War One
and Sarah Schneer. Beis Yaakov started in between 1911 and 1921. And of course, World War One destroyed Jewish life entirely in between. So in reality, the Chafetz Chaim publishes it in 1921, a decade later than I had said. And when Beis Yaakov was already a reality and schools were being opened and Sarah Schneer was already teaching. And in Likutei Halachos, which is one of the many Sfarim of the Chafetz Chaim, it's also his yard site now, so that's also appropriate. Where this Isser of teaching girls Torah is mentioned in Sait, so Chafetz Chaim writes it as a footnote, not in the body of the text. He writes it as a footnote that in our times, there's changing times, girls are not, they're being exposed to the foreign culture, like you said, they're learning their languages. He said very often they're not even living in their parents' home, which is reflective also of the times, that many young teenage children, boys and girls, are moving away from the shtetl to the cities. They're going to gymnasiums. They're going to seek work, to seek employment. There is no longer any employment in the small market towns of the industrialization that was reaching Eastern Europe at the time, causes the whole economic system to change as well. And there is this tremendous not just a generation gap, but a cultural gap, a religious gap between the parents and the children, and especially the girls, who are no longer exposed to any absorption of that atmosphere of Yiddishkeit, which had been taken for granted for generations. So the Chafetz Chaim says, in today's day and age, this Isser does not apply. Not only that, but it is a great mitzvah to teach them Torah, and then he limits it. He qualifies it by specifying what type of Torah he means, and he lists a few sfarim, and then that leaves the question is, so what about other sfarim? Is that not a great mitzvah? It's only a little mitzvah. Is it not a great mitzvah, but it's mutter? Or is it not a great mitzvah, but it's still the old Isser? And that, I'm sure, the people who are knowledgeable of halacha will have a lot to say about that. But that, when the Chafetz Chaim said that, the Chafetz Chaim is expressing a historical phenomenon. He's looking around, and he's saying, this is what's happening in history. It's dangerous. The world has changed. We have to recognize and confront the fact that the world is changing around us. We can't stick to the old ideals anymore. It's not going to work. Like you said, World War One had happened in between. I'm talking about 1921 already. And we have to do something. And that have to is we have to save the Torah by teaching them Torah. And that's the only way that it's going to work.
Mm-hmm. What age girls did Sarah Schneer start with?
It's a great question. The Sarah Schneer, when she's inspired to start, she was, a very fascinating woman. We could speak for an hour just about who Sarah Schneer was and her accomplishment, an amazing woman. But she was very knowledgeable, very self-taught, very her own person, very independent, very religious, very frum. But also very, aware of what was going on, and she herself was very well read in literature, secular subjects as well. And during World War One, like many Jews from Galicia, she grew up in Krakow. She came from a Belzer Hasidic family in Krakow, and she escapes, like many other Jews of the area, to Vienna, to the capital of the empire. And there she goes to. She ends up in a shul that the Rav was Rabbi Dr. Moshe David Flesch, who was a Talmud of Reb Shlomo Breuer, the son-in-law of Reb Shlomo Schneifel Hirsch. And he, the way he spoke, first of all, he addressed the women directly in the shul, in the Zasnasha, which was unheard of in Krakow and the Hasidic Galicia that she came from. The rabbis talked about women, what the husbands needed to do for their wives or their daughters, but not to the women. And here he was speaking directly to them and giving them a message. And she started speaking to him. And he introduced her to Rav Shamshon Afol Hirsch's world, his philosophy, his ideas. He tells her to read the 19 letters in Chayrib. And this becomes the Bible of Beis Yaakov. The Beis Yaakov lock, stock, and barrel is based on Rav Shamshon Afol Hirsch. That was the first Torah education for girls was started in Frankfurt 75 years earlier, and almost. And she bases it on that, And she goes, she says, I'm going to start a school for girls. She comes back to Krakow in 1917. She starts with a group of older girls. And it didn't work. You asked what age. So it started with older girls to give them like a club. It wasn't even a school. It was like a social club. We're from, we're going to stay from, we're going to stay strong. And we're going to use these classes and shiurim and ideas to try to connect us to Yiddish. And it didn't work. They were already too advanced. They were already too independent. They mocked her. They called her a frumi. After a short period of time, she realized it has to start from the younger kids before they get lost. And she starts with younger girls. She starts it with the elementary school age, and that's how it goes for several years.
And in Krakow, this is in Krakow, the girls living at home?
All in Krakow, yeah. Eventually, you know, it started to grow very quickly. It's a movement that grew very quickly. I mean, talking about within 2-3 years of, before even the funding and infrastructure fell into place, it already had, you know, spread to other towns and schools were opening. It was something that literally took off incredibly fast. And it moves up. It becomes a full elementary school and kind of like a high school age also. And that's how it built up. It developed. She started from the young girls and then it just moved up through. We would call it 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade in Polish. It was recognized by the Polish government, so it went according to the Polish school system, and went up to whatever grade the regular schools around, the non-Jewish schools around, went to.
Mm-hmm. So much is said about Sarah Schneer and what she accomplished. But not much is said about the opposition and the controversy around her. We know there was opposition, but we don't hear much about who they were and what actually happened. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the opposition was from the establishment. She was doing something that was revolutionary, that was wrong, that was considered wrong by many people. When someone proposed at a earlier, also in Krakow, ironically, in 1903, 15 years before she started, a rabbinical conference in Krakow, someone proposed Menachem Mendel something Landau, was a rav in a town in Poland near Warsaw, Nowitwór. He proposed that maybe to solve all the problems that are facing the Jewish girls, that we should start a girls' education, Torah education for girls. And Rabbi Yo Akiva Rabinovich, the Poltava rav, who was a very strong and dynamic leader at the time, he got up and said, they're going to bring this terrible Haskalah idea into the religious Jewish camp, into our religious world. How can we even entertain such an idea? So it was the rabbinic establishment, the religious establishment was completely opposed to it. And it was very revolutionary, very new, and considered very wrong. So that's where the opposition came from, and that's what she had to deal with. There were rebbes who said it in Galicia is where she's starting. Remember, it's Galicia. It's not Poland, it's not Lithuania, it's not Germany, it's not Hungary. In Galicia, who said it's not allowed to send to Beis Yaakov, the Kedushas Tzion of Baba, and the irony of ironies, her own rebbe, the Rebbe Rabbi Yisachar Doiva Belz, they're not allowed Belzards. Why is that such an irony? Because he was the one who gave her the bracha. When she started, her brother said to her, what are you getting involved in politics? If you start a school system, it means you're going to be involved in Jewish politics. What do you need to be involved in? So already then, education and politics was mixed. It's not a new thing. So he said to her, you have to go to get a bracha from our rebbe. So she said, okay, we'll get a bracha. He schlepped her to the Belz Rebbe, to Marienbad, where he was at the time. And he says he writes a kvittel. He goes in with her to the Rebbe. He writes a kvittel. He said, and the kvittel, it said, she wants to educate B'nai Yisrael in the spirit of Yiddishkeit and Torah. Something along those lines. Educate Jewish daughters in the Jewish derech. Something like that. A one-liner. In other words,
no detail.
That it was a school system, that it was formal education, that he was teaching them Torah. Didn't say any of that. Didn't say that. It said that line that I told you. She wants to educate the nice Yisrael in the spirit of Yiddishkeit and Torah. And she didn't say a word to the rabbi, and neither did the brother. They handed the kvittel to the rabbi Rabbi Yisachar Doiv says to her, bracha v'atzlacha. Now that bracha v'atzlacha from the Rebbe Bishachar Levy is a big thing. You don't want to joke about that. And Sarah Shanir took it very seriously. And it, we can easily say, and this is accepted in the Beis Yaakov movement until today, that that bracha v'atzlacha, the Rebbe Bishachar Levy, is what made the movement happen. And it's and that's, I don't know, I accept that. That seems very plausible to me. He was one of the biggest tzaddikim in the world at the time. And he gave a bracha v'atzlacha to the movement. But at the end of the day, he didn't support it. He didn't back it up. He didn't write her a letter of support. He didn't come tell everyone, send your daughters to the school. Fund for, he didn't say you should fund the school. He didn't do any of that. In fact, he said that the Belzer should not send to the school. So there's opposition is everywhere. No mm-hmm. one's supporting her. She's on her own.
Right. So you might even say that actions speak louder than words in this case.
Right. Maybe. In 1928, there's a letter that comes out from Reb Chaim Isaac Grudzinski and the Ger Rebbe to support Beis Yaakov. So you have public support in a public letter. A year later, the 1929, the Ger Rebbe has another letter. The Ger Rebbe is the one who really was the first big gadol who comes out publicly, and even before that, not publicly, in support of Beis Yaakov. And because of his prestige and his stance, that you know gave it the rabbinic backing. Now, a couple of years later, the Chafetz Chaim wrote a letter. And there's a whole issue in Freistadt in Galicia, not far from Rimenup, where there was opposition to starting a school, and the Agudas Yisrael asked the Chafetz Chaim, who was literally months before he was to pass away, to write a letter in support of Beis Yaakov. So the Chafetz Chaim writes a letter. Keep in mind, this is 15, 16 years after the movement is around, and there's thousands of students, possibly tens of thousands, and tens of schools, possibly hundreds.
Okay, so now let's get to the topic on hand, which is seminaries. I want to talk about seminaries. So when did the first seminary for women open?
Well, what happened is that the Sarah Shanir became a victim of her own success. She was so successful, and more branches are opening up, and schools are opening up, and the enrollment is high, and there's no teachers. Why is there no teachers? Because no one had ever been trained to be a teacher because the concept didn't exist. So she simply needed teachers. So she went ahead in her again. She started again from scratch, right? This time it's not for the school. The school's already taken off. She again, in 1922, 5 years after she started her first school, in again in her apartment, her little two-room apartment, she starts a teacher's seminary. What did a teacher's seminary mean? Simply a couple of teenage graduates from her high school. She personally teaches them how to be teachers. So she should have teachers. You know, this, you know, once Agoda got involved, so they got her a bigger apartment, eight-room apartment, and then in 1931, they built the iconic building, which still stands, which once upon a time, there was something called traveling to Europe, and I used to, in the old world, I used to actually lead groups.
When there was such a thing as live groups, yeah.
Yeah.
Getting people getting together.
Right. And so we go to the building. We go to the original building, the teacher's seminary of Beis Yaakov, built in 1931, a beautiful big five-floor building where she taught, and other teachers, you know, a whole big staff, very you know good staff. She brought from Germany, all these professional educators from Germany.
Graduates from Rav Shamshon Feld Hirsch's school.
His world. Exactly. Dr. Judith Grunfeld and Dr. Leo Deutschlander and all kinds of other teachers. Either way, so that's the first teacher seminary, and it's simply a function of the fact that there's a desperate need for teachers. Then Beis Yaakov as an organization, not specifically Sarah Shanir, opens another one in Chernivtsi, another one in Vienna, a small one in Bratislava, which is Presburg in Slovakia, and there's several teacher seminaries that exist in Eastern Europe and Central Europe before the war to train teachers, simply because this movement is growing by leaps and bounds, by simply astronomical numbers, exponential growth, and there's this constant desperate need for teachers, so we need to have teacher seminaries to train those teachers. They have summer retreats to train them, all kinds of things like that. That's when the idea of a teacher seminary in Beis Yaakov started. Mm-hmm.
So this was strictly for teachers. It wasn't a standard for all girls.
Oh, no, it was a very elite institution. It was hard to get in. Regular Beis Yaakovs, they recruited them. The goal of Beis Yaakov schools and the goal of teacher seminaries were two very different goals. The goals of the Beis Yaakov schools were to save Yiddishkeit, to save the Jewish people, to save them from assimilation, to save them from becoming non-Jews, simple as put. And they wanted to get every single Jewish girl out there, every single Jewish girl in Poland, in Eastern Europe. We have to get them into Beis Yaakov school. That was the goal. They succeeded beyond their wildest dreams, but still they didn't get every girl, obviously. But that was the goal. So they tried to recruit every girl that could come. The goal of the teacher seminaries was to train professional teachers. It was very elite, very hard to get into. It was only for, yechidim, very specific individuals who wanted to be teachers, who were willing to do it. It took a lot. You had to go on your own as a teenage girl to a town and start fighting with the establishment there to build a school and fighting with parents to send their kids to the school when the girl is 17, 18 years old. So you're talking about a very unique type of individual who's got to have very, very good training to be able to do such a thing. So that's a very, very limited goal, and it was limited in scope.
And how long was the seminary training for?
It depended. Some of them were a year or two.
Mm-hmm. And did they live? They lived in the building. They had rooms there.
The novelty of the Beis Yaakov Seminary, as far as what we spoke about earlier about the heter of learning Torah, was even bigger. Because here, essentially, you're starting a yeshiva. You're starting a yeshiva for girls. It's a dormitory, which is the first time that ever happened. The schools were obviously not dormitories. Dining room, Shabbosim, Yantif, you daven Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, together, all the girls. You had intensive learning because they're training to become teachers, not just the basics like they're giving in the elementary school. And there was that was like a whole new level of revolutionary, type of institution that took off with the seminary.
Mm-hmm. Who paid for all of this? Like, who funded this? Obviously, the girls themselves came from very poverty-stricken homes. They couldn't pay for all this. Who funded it?
So the majority, the regular schools, the majority was paid for by two things. They I got to make sure that it was accredited by the Polish government. So there's government funding. It's an officially recognized school. There's a lot of government funding. And, they went through the Polish, what you have in New York, or regions or finals or whatever it is. So they had those tests, and you had to learn those subjects. You had to have everything that the Polish government, in order to be recognized, some of them were more like afternoon schools. The girls went to public school in the morning and they went to the Beis Yaakov afternoon school, especially in the smaller towns. It really depended on each place. There was a lot, it wasn't like a very uniform curriculum because a lot of it depended on each locality, what was possible to build in that specific place. But a lot of the funding came from Agudas Yisrael, Keren HaTorah. The Keren HaTorah constantly fundraised and gave a large chunk of what they fundraised to Beis Yaakov. And then there was tuition, especially in the teacher seminaries. The students of the teacher seminaries came primarily from the upper middle class, rich Hasidim, who wanted, from Sostovich, wealthy businessmen, Hasidim, who wanted their girls to not just get a Beis Yaakov education, but become a teacher, and they would pay the tuition. So there was tuition in some schools, and especially in the seminaries.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, so going over to the modern era, after World War II, there's America, there's Eretz Yisrael, even Europe, and the seminaries that are started in all those continents. Well, how did those come about?
So I know less about the United States, which I assume is the primary focus. I'll speak a little bit about Israel and a drop about the United States, and we'll try to bring it up until the modern era. Anything contemporary, I'm very much unaware. And not only am I Israeli, but my girls are very young, so I would never have gone through the experience yet. So I'm not really in the seminary scene, but as far as history is concerned, in Beis Yaakov and Eretz Yisrael, we'll start with that. We'll go to, I'll jump back to the United States, and we'll try to tie it all together quickly. So in Eretz Yisrael, you have the first Beis Yaakov school before we get to seminary, because the seminary is an outgrowth of the school. It started by Meir Sharansky in Tel Aviv in 1933, so it's pre-war. A couple of years later, Reb Hillel Lieberman starts in Yerushalayim, and he's shortly afterwards joined a few years later by Pinchas Levin, who comes from the Gerer's aristocracy, from the Bendina Rav and Rabbi Shemaya Levin, from the Israeli politics and So he's one of the Levines. And Rav Pinchas Levine and Rav Hillel Lieberman, they start the first Beis Yaakov in Yerushalayim. Later, a Yekir, a German Jew, start, Rabbi Yosef Avraham Wolf, starts the first Beis Yaakov in Bnei Brak with the encouragement of the Chazon Ish. But that's in the 1950s. That's pretty much later. Okay? So you have the 1930s in Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim. You have in the 1950s in Bnei Brak. Beis Yaakov is starting to get off the ground. Now, the same thing that faced Sarah Schneer is faced by Meir Sharansky and later Hillel Lieberman and Pinchas Levine, is that they're starting in a desert and they start growing and there's no teachers. There's no teachers. What are we going to do? I spoke to a daughter of a woman who was one of the first Beis Yaakov teachers in Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s. She came. She grew up in Bendin in Poland. She studied by Sarah Schneer in Krakow, and then she moved to Eretz Yisrael in the 1930s. And her daughter told me that her mother was hired by Rav Hillel Lieberman in Yerushalayim. And he said, I need you because I need religious teachers. In the meantime, most of the subjects are taught by irreligious teachers because I don't have any religious teachers. And I need someone like you. You come from Sarah Schneer herself. So that's the situation they're facing. So they simply go ahead and start a teacher seminary. It made the most sense. You don't have teachers, start a teacher seminary. So they start. Tel Aviv, Yerushalayim, they start already in the 1930s. Again, there's still a whole world in Europe. So you have the first teacher seminary, and again, it's to fill a desperate need. 1950s, something changes. In the 1950s, what starts to develop in Eretz Yisrael is what's known in Hebrew as the Chevrat HaLomdim, the Society of Learners, where because of the Chazon Ish and other factors that were involved, there's a growing number of young men who continue their studies in Kail after marriage, and they would need a way to make a living. So they said, hey, there's always this desperate need for Beis Yaakov teachers. Why don't we encourage future Kail wives to continue their studies after post-high school into a teacher seminary? They'll become a Beis Yaakov teacher, and they'll make a respectable living. They're paid for by the Israeli government, by the Ministry of Education. They have summers off. They have afternoons off. It's a cushy job. It's a Torah-ridiker job, and they'll support their husbands. So it became a function of the developing Haredi society. And because of that, it became almost mandatory to continue after high school into a teacher seminar. What happened? God blessed the Haredi society with a huge demographic growth and success. They became this huge society. In the 1980s, the supply of teachers far outweighed the demand because everyone was continuing post high school into the teacher seminaries. The 1980s, they developed in the seminaries that not only are going to study how to become a Beis Yaakov teacher, you'll also learn professions. And there was a bunch of different professions. You could become learn bookkeeping and all kinds of other professions. And because the Israeli government funds the Beis Yaakov schools in Israel, so they have a lot to say about what the curriculum should be and about what professions they should be teaching. And there's always this back and forth about adding different professional tracks because, to be honest, you don't need that many teachers. The teacher's training is superfluous. You have a few teachers, that's enough. So the teacher seminaries at this point in Israel have become professional training, with one of the tracks being teacher's training to supply that need. That's the post-high school, and that's how it developed in Israel. And in the United States, it started off in a very similar way. How did Beis Yaakov start there? First and famously was Rebbe Simchna Kaplan, one of the prime, she's a legend, she's the Sarah Schneer of America, without question. And she's the architect in Williamsburg. There's also Rabbi Ram Newhaus, the Telzer, and he was very involved. And there's all types of other people also. I don't want to give the whole history of Beis Yaakov over the United States at this point, but in the late 1930s, they're starting Beis Yaakov in America, Williamsburg, and later in Borough Park and Lower East Side, and it branches out. Vichna Kaplan, Rebbetzin Vichna Kaplan, is facing the same exact issue. There are no teachers, and we have this, everyone sending their kids to public school. We want kids to go to Beis Yaakov in the United States. We need teachers. So she starts the first teacher seminar. And it was, again, very simple to fill a need. We don't have any, we need. Let's start, and very similar to Sarah Schneer, she starts it in her living room. So she goes ahead, and that pioneer, and goes ahead to fill the need to have teachers and teacher seminaries. What The next development of the seminary world is we somehow combine the Israeli and American story. In the post Six-Day War era, boys, males, they start coming to yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael to learn. There's a little bit of a trickle before the Six-Day War, but it really starts to become more in style in the late 1960s, early 70s, to Mir, to Brisk, to other yeshivas. And at that time, girls started to come, or the idea of girls to, I'll be honest, I don't exactly know why girls started coming, what came first, the chicken or the egg. But remember I mentioned Hillel Lieberman and Pinchas Levine's Beis Yaakov. They opened up a branch of that Beis Yaakov. I didn't get clear exactly what year it was. It seems to be either late 60s or early 70s. And they opened this branch of their Beis Yaakov for Americans coming from the United States to Israel to study in a teacher seminary. What they're establishing is not a Beis Yaakov high school or elementary school for Americans. They're establishing a teacher seminary for Americans to come and study. That is what we know today as BJJ. And they hire Yitzhak Kuttner's daughter, a very capable Rebbetzin, may she live and be well, Rebbetzin Beruya David, to be the head of the school, and it takes off. So the idea of the seminary, again, I don't know if they measured the market. Was there a desperate need at that time? Did they need to have these teachers? Why did they need to be trained in Israel? I don't know. I'll be honest. I don't know exactly how that phenomenon came about, but that's how the Israel scene of Americans started, and it was seemingly to produce teachers. It was a teacher seminary, and it was created to produce those teachers.
Mm-hmm. So that part of the seminary obviously wasn't funded by the Israeli government because the students were coming from America. Is that correct?
I would imagine you're correct. It's very likely the way schools are set up in Israel is that if the institution is an Israeli institution, they could get funding for an American program. There are ways to do that. And if there's a way to do it, then you can be sure that Ger Hasidim running an institution will find a way to get it. So I imagine that there is some sort of funding from the Israeli government, but I can't say for sure. I never looked into that.
Okay, so it seems like the modern-day seminary, especially today where it's almost universal, that almost every girl in America or abroad goes to Eretz Yisrael to seminary, is very different from the original purpose of the seminary, which was to train teachers.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what goes on in seminaries today, if they're training teachers or not, but I can say for sure that in history, it was to fill a need that existed, that we must have teachers, and therefore we need a teacher seminary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this was a fascinating discussion, really, really informative and comprehensive. I really highly recommend everyone listen to Yehuda's podcast called Jewish History Soundbites, where he's discussing this very subject. So thank you very much, Yehuda, for joining us.
Thank you.